A warm green belt welcome to Anna Kessel.
Thank you. Thanks so much for coming. And I'm so sorry about this screen because, ironically, part of this session is about making women in sport visible. But perhaps it's just sort of kind of symbolic of the situation that you find ourselves in anyway, which we're going to be talking about a bit more. Can everybody sort of see the screen? Oh, you're all so polite. I love it. Thank you. So my name is Anna Kessel. I've been writing about sport for the last 14, 15 years for The Guardian. And I'm going to tell you a bit more about how I became a campaigner along the way. But I definitely didn't start out as a sports billy at all. As the title of the talk suggests, I did bunk all of my PE lessons, really from year nine onwards. And nobody really seemed to notice. So the title of the talk is technically how to bunk a PE lesson, but I don't think any of you are going to need any tips because it's not that hard. I found it wasn't. Oh, no, we really can't see anything. Can you see that? It's the Spice Girls. It's going to become a bit of a quiz, really. Maybe the people on this side will fill in the people on that side. So the reason why I've put a picture of the Spice Girls up is because I think they, well, not only were they sort of the soundtrack of much of my youth, not by choice, they just were around. There's something about the Spice Girls that I think really typifies our ideas about women and sport. Namely, because there's one Spice Girl, Sporty Spice. And I think the way that we've always presented sport to women and young girls is that you can be the sporty one and fit into a really rigid idea about what being sporty is for women and girls. Or you can be one of the other ones. You could be the sexy one or the scary one or the fun one or whatever the other ones were all called. There was a really... Does anyone remember Ali G? Yeah, yeah. Do you remember when he interviewed Posh and Becks? Yeah, in the sort of era where they wore matching outfits. It was quite memorable. And he sat down and he talked about Sporty Spice to Posh. And he said, well, if the best footballer in the world goes out with the fittest Spice Girl in the band, then who does Sporty Spice go out with? And the punchline was someone from Scunthorpe United. Who at the time were doing rubbish. Exactly, exactly. And that was this idea, you know, as I was growing up, that if you were a woman who was sporty, that was just anathema to being a woman and everything that you should not aspire to as a teenage girl. So very, very depressing. can anybody on this... Oh, no, let me start this side of the tent. Can anybody recognise any of these images? Can you make them out? Martina Navratilova, thank you. Anyone else? Can you make out the others? Shira, I love that you know Shira. How do you know Shira? I thought it was only children of the 80s who did. Gladiators, hit Saturday night TV show. And on the far right, Flojo, yes. So when I was growing up as a kid, even though I wasn't sporty in any sense, I had these, now I look back at it and think about it, my sheroes were really quite powerful, sporty, or at least physical women. I don't know why that was the case, but it was. So I loved She-Ra, even though now I look at her and I kind of think, oh, she had, I don't know, she's kind of more sexy than she's not the sort of hero that I present to my six-year-old daughter now, I don't think. But certainly at the time, you know, she could kill monsters and throw mountains, and that was pretty cool. And there was definitely a shortage of heroines. Gladiators, again, was a really refreshing image, although, again, the women tended to be a little bit sexed up. And I remember at one point, Jet was, like, on every lads mag going as this desirable woman. But it was really quite groundbreaking that these super muscly women who were very athletic and above all competitive, they actually wanted to win and they weren't afraid of that feeling. We were watching them. We loved it every Saturday night at 6 o'clock. Martina Navratilova, I loved her. She was a groundbreaking tennis player, not only because of the millions of Grand Slams that she won, but for me personally, as sort of 10-year-old girl the fact that she wore shorts. I couldn't understand why no other tennis players wore shorts. It just seemed so obvious to me. And on the right, Flojo, well, she just, apart from being world record holder in the 1 and 200 metres, some suspicions about that, but we won't cover that here. Her incredible outfits, I mean, that's a one-legged jumpsuit. She wore all silver. She had huge nails, flowing hair. She was very much an icon at the time. So these were my unexpected sheroes. In my house, sport wasn't really something that was popular. My dad was from South Africa, and so his relationship to sport was very much defined through apartheid, the international boycott of South African sport, the fact that, you know, even today in South African sport, we still see the legacy of apartheid, and we're talking about quotas and that struggle to really celebrate black excellence in South African sport. And on the left-hand side, a picture of the 1936 Olympic Games. My mum's family are from Czech Republic. And so for her, sport was very much dominated by these totalitarian regimes of communism and Nazism and the way that sport was used to manipulate ideology. And I think even today, you know, there's such a swell of movement to talk about the power of sport for change. The United Nations have this amazing strapline that sport has the power to change the world for women and girls. And I love that they think it's so integral to gender equality. And I completely agree that we talk about the power of football. All of these things are wonderful, but we must not, I don't think, treat sport as some kind of panacea. It's not a utopia. It's open to exploitation like any other thing in the world. And what better example than the recent horrific US gymnastics case of sexual abuse that took place by Dr. Larry Nassar. So after, well, I don't know, about at least a good sort of 5 years of bunking PE, literally marched out the front gate, nobody minded. I once tried it with maths. I bunked a maths lesson and I was hauled up to my head of year so fast. I never, ever tried that again. I was literally never told off about bunking PE, which gave me a really clear message that nobody minded. Nobody was going to be made accountable for it, and I was not going to be made accountable for it. And actually, when I started talking about all this recently, my mum was like, I had no idea that you bunked PE. So clearly, a letter never went home. Later on, I went to Cambridge University, unexpectedly. It wasn't part of the tradition in my family, certainly. And I'd stumbled into this huge, pressured, I don't want to swear, very frightening culture, really, in many ways. Completely different to the state school that I'd gone to. Found it very hard. Many people did find it hard. And I didn't really have a way of coping with it. Strangely, a way did emerge, and I started going to these aerobics classes in a little church hall on the outskirts of Cambridge. Most of the women at the aerobics class were a lot older than me. Many sort of were mothers or grandmothers even, and they were having the most brilliant time. And they turn up in these, I mean, one woman, she used to wear the most amazing lycra, purple lycra outfits, very 80s with the sort of high cut over the top of the leggings with the leg warmers and very Jane Fonda. Thank you. Oh, isn't that lovely? And then we all got on down with a bit of jazz hands to Destiny's Child, who did the grapevine. And there was something about these women, there's a little warning thing that's popped up on there, just so you know. Something about these women enjoying themselves in a really uninhibited way. It was such a natural way. They were getting really sweaty, they were working out, they were laughing, they were smiling. And they were... they were going home at the end of the evening, having had this wonderful time. And, you know, I think aerobics has always been sold to us as this place where you have to lose weight and, you know, it's all about sculpting your body and trying to look a certain way and fitting into a certain idea of femininity. But this wasn't it at all. This wasn't what was happening. And I started to realise that exercise and physical movement was this hugely important element in releasing stress, in getting away from the cerebral, escaping into a more simple place, which wasn't troubled by all these kind of academic pressures. And I think I've been absolutely thrilled to see that in recent years we've talked more and more about sport and exercise and the power it has to change our mental health. Not on its own, of course, but in part. Oh, that's really hard to see that one. Against all the odds, I ended up becoming a sports journalist and have been very, very lucky to travel the world and experience 3 Olympic Games, World Championships. I followed the career of Usain Bolt and Jessica Ennis-Hill, which has been wonderful and a privilege. But all the way through, I began to be more and more aware of the hugely stark inequalities in the way that we covered sport. Often I wouldn't be covering women's sport at all. That was the norm. Even, you know, in the last few years, there was a statistic that something like only 2% of sports coverage in newspapers is for women. So sports, only 2% of the sports pages are covering women's sport, 98% covering men's sport, which I find incredibly shocking. But I was there, I was part of it. I was trying to challenge it, but it was difficult. And even when we did cover women's sport, it was very apparent that it wasn't on the same platform, wasn't on the same level. And I always remember it, 2008, when Usain Bolt burst onto the scene and he did that marvellous run at the finish line where he glanced over at his time and beat his chest. And that same Olympic Games, the Jamaican sprinters in the women's 100 metres performed incredibly, and Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce and others sat there afterwards in the press conference and talked about the anger that they felt, that their stories were not known, that people didn't even know their names, and yet there they were. They'd won gold medals. It wasn't even about the money. It was just they weren't getting that attention and their frustration at how competitive and compelling the women's race is, but people just didn't see it that way. They were only interested in Bolt. So that really started my journey in terms of thinking about inequality. I found this photo recently. It's pretty hard to see, especially if you're over there. if you want to see it more clearly, I suggest you go and Google it afterwards. But it's a photo of some of the women from the US Olympic team from Rio. Hopefully you can see that they are all different sizes, all different body shapes. Not just shapes, but different kinds of musculature, different strengths in different places. I think this photo really beautifully illustrates who sport is for. You know, going back to that picture of Sporty Spice and thinking about women and sport as such a narrow definition, I think this picture actually totally blasts through all of that. The only slight caveat I would put is that, of course, it doesn't represent disability sport, and it also doesn't represent women who wear hijab or want to dress modestly. This picture of Serena Williams, I really hope you can see it a little bit because she's just joyful. How does sporty make us feel? I think that's one of the most important questions that have been left out for women for so long. That sport is either this sports billy, sort of really niche, geeky thing that some women will engage in but most won't, or sport and exercise is this kind of punitive regime where it's really all about sculpting your body to a kind of male ideal that's been around for a very long time. I think this photo and thinking more about how women feel when they move their bodies should really be the starting point for anyone's journey in sport and exercise. How does it make us feel? We don't talk enough about playing for women. You know, when I think about some of the adverts that reigned at my 2- and 6-year-old girls, they talk about how sparkly hair clips are fun. Yeah, I mean, I think sparkly hair clips are really nice. I think they have a certain amount of entertainment, but I don't think they're really fun. I don't think they're really conducive to play. And that continues on into adulthood, I think, when we talk about, you know, makeup or spa days or... And I'm not slamming any of that stuff, because all of that stuff is lovely. I enjoy it myself. But I think there's something really fundamental about play that women miss out on. And I see it in my male friends and my husband and his friends and the way that they go and play, you know, for example, five-a-side football. And a lot of them are not very good. But nobody really minds, because it's something that they do together. They're playing it together. And it's almost a bit of a joke about who's good or who thinks they're good and who's actually a bit shit. But maybe that week they scored an amazing goal and, you know, they were absolute hero for a day. With women, there's so many layers of judgment around, oh, well, I don't know if I could go and play a sport because not even if I'd look silly, but what if I wouldn't know what to do? I might be humiliated. I might be embarrassing. We're not just playing for the sake of it, for the sake of enjoyment. Why do we have to be so brilliant at everything all the time? Why can't we be a bit rubbish? Now that the sun's come out, you obviously haven't been praying hard enough. There are no dark clouds, and I can practically not see that screen at all. On this screen are a series of images of women who have excelled in their careers. So from Condoleezza Rice to Sheryl Sandberg, women who we wouldn't necessarily connect with sport, but interestingly, all have sport in their locker. They all played sport up to quite a high level in their lives. The sun's just slightly going in, so you're obviously responding, that's nice. There's also Marjorie Scardino, right at the bottom in the glasses. She's the first woman to be a director on the board of Twitter, and she used to be a rodeo rider, which I think is wonderful. And I asked her about it, and I said, oh, I really want to interview you about being a rodeo rider. And she emailed me back, and she said, I'm not going to tell you about that. I mean, a rodeo rider, what's interesting about that? I Googled it. I thought it was just absolutely outstanding. I recommend that you Google barrel racing. There was some research that came out just a couple of years ago that EY did, and they looked at all of their female employees around the world. And they found that 89% of the women at the top level, the women executives, had played sport to college or university level. And they found that really interesting. Why were women with a sporting background succeeding more in their careers? There's all the obvious things like teamwork and discipline and learning how to work hard. Yes. But there was one crucial element that they uncovered, which I think is really interesting, and it was learning how to fail and learning how to bounce back. So when you play sport, you routinely have to mess up. You know, if you're learning how to serve in tennis, you're going to get it wrong a whole lot of times before you ever get it right. And even when you know how to serve, you're still going to get it wrong all the time. And you're going to take criticism from your coach, and you're going to take criticism from your opponent, and then you're going to come back from it. That's the idea anyway. In real life, women don't get to rehearse that enough. So the theory says when we go out into the workplace and we mess up, we go out into the workplace and we ask for a pay rise and we're told no, we're frightened to bounce back and ask again the next week or ask for more. Sport is a really important tool that could change that, potentially, for women and girls. Oh, this is such a shame that you can't see this properly. Does anybody know Body Posy Panda on Instagram? Yeah? She's so great. Megan Jane Crabb. So hopefully you can just about make out that the image on the left is a very slim-looking woman, and we can kind of make out her abdominals. The image on the right is a much curvier version of the same woman. That's the image on the left is the before picture, and the image on the right is the after picture. And what I love about this is that ordinarily, of course, it is switched around, yeah? And funnily enough, a diet pill company in the last couple of months took these two very images and switched them the opposite way around and used it to sell their diet pills without Megan's permission, which just goes to show you how much absolute bullcrap there is in the diet pill industry. But Megan's message is about body positivity, about embracing your body, about accepting who you are. And her journey is really about how the person on the left, the Megan on the left, was somebody who was struggling with eating disorders, over-exercising, with this idea that if only she could look differently, if only she could be slimmer, she would be happier. She had this kind of utopia in her head that if she could travel towards this place, if she could attain those weight goals, image goals, she would find a happiness. And I think that whether we have eating disorders or not, it's something that's an idea that's very, very familiar to many women and increasingly, I think, many men too. That if we could find this place where we look right, we will feel right. And it's just complete rubbish, frankly. It's just rubbish. It's not true at all. And Megan has obviously found that out herself and been on a very different journey where she eventually learned to accept who she was and stop having these eating disorders and exercise for joy rather than for punishment and losing weight, and is now a much more natural body shape that works for her. I absolutely love her message. And she says, love your body for what it can do, not how it looks. I can't even read the bit below it, so I'm not going to try. My eyesight is definitely failing. Oh, okay. Can you vaguely make out this woman? I love your nods. Thank you. You're so kind. This is Jessamyn Stanley. She is an incredible African-American woman who started yoga a few years ago and is completely tearing up the yoga space. I'm a huge yoga fan. It's a really, really integral part of my life. But there's a problem with yoga, a very big problem with yoga, in the way that it's interpreted in the global north, in the Western Hemisphere. It is a very white, elitist, thin privilege activity. And if you go into a yoga class, it tends to cost quite a lot of money, and it's not very representative of our society. Jessamyn Stanley is a really important person that's challenging that and showing us that physical activity, whether it's yoga or anything else, can be done by anybody and beautifully. I mean, she's just... That image there is just stunning. I'm just going to check the time. I'm going to take you through some more amazing women who are kind of smashing these barriers and ideas about who can do sport and in what way they can do it. Jessica Ennis-Hill. Now, she might not strike you as somebody who has had to contend with any barriers. I mean, you know, she won Olympic gold at the London 2012 Games. She's highly successful, national treasure. What has she had to contend with? Well, starting out, the image on the left, you can just about make out, she's running alongside another athlete called Tatiana Chernova, who's much taller than her. Jess Ennis is only about 5'6", which is extremely slight for a woman who has to compete in the high jump, for example. So from very early on, she was seen as, well, she's nicknamed Tadpole, for a start, which is not a particularly winning moniker. And she was easily dismissed. The picture on the far right is taken around the time of the London 2012 Olympic Games. And I think even with the sunlight and the ambient lighting, you can probably make out that she has the most phenomenal abdominals. I mean, they are just, she's just steel. That being said, ahead of the London 2012 Olympic Games, I don't know if you remember, there was this story about how Jessica Ennis was called fat by one of the high-performance coaches in British athletics. It was a huge story at the time. The front pages of newspapers, and everybody was staring at these images of Jessica's abdominals, thinking, how on earth can anybody say that she's fat? Of course, they didn't mean it in aesthetic terms. They meant it in performance terms. So within sport itself, there are these very rigid ideas about what women's bodies should be like. What should be our fat-to-muscle ratios? When you start to uncover the layers, you find a really troubling lack of awareness about women's bodies. When I was researching for Eat, Sweat, Play, I discovered that a tiny, tiny percentage of sports science is performed on or is researched on women's bodies. So we really don't understand, of course, things like periods or the menopause. We don't know enough about that and the impact that it has on women's bodies, even at elite athlete level. But we also don't know more basic things. We don't know how, at what best level women should perform. We don't know what that fat ratio should be. And subsequently, many female athletes have come out and said, I actually perform much, much better when I'm at a heavier weight. Men and women's bodies are just completely different, and the scientific awareness around it is out of date. Oh, and the picture in the middle, of course, when Jess then became pregnant. And it was, it was national news headlines, and Sky News said, oh, is she going to have the ambition to go and win a medal? Will she still be hungry enough? And wonderfully, 13 months after having her son, Reggie, she went and won the world title, which I think is fantastic. Serena Williams, when is she not in the headlines? Has anybody seen the news about her catsuit? Yeah, so anybody who hasn't seen it, she's been banned from the French Open her catsuit has been banned from the French Open because they say it's disrespectful to the tradition of the French Open. Yeah. It's ridiculous, right? I mean, what hasn't she been banned from? What hasn't she been targeted for? But I think this particular instance is really informative and interesting. That suit that she was wearing last year was a protective suit to support her after all the difficulties that she had after giving birth to Olympia. So she was experiencing blood clots and things like that at the time, and this suit was specifically designed to support her performance. And the great irony about this decision by the French Open is that one of the greatest ever French tennis players, well, arguably the greatest, Suzanne Longlong, who was playing in the 1920s, she was a huge rebel. She was the first tennis player to refuse to wear corsets, chuck them out the window. She shortened her skirts. She was bare-armed. How horrific. It's really interesting when you see the pictures of the tennis players who wore corsets. I don't know how they managed to play at all. I mean, it's just mind-boggling. And then Suzanne. And the one other wonderful thing about Suzanne was that in between sets, she'd sip on brandy. And she also liked to heckle the umpire and swear a lot. But the most important thing about her was that she campaigned to let people know that the clothing that women wore instructed their performance, and that the clothing that women wore for sport had to be conducive to playing sport. And I find it absolutely astonishing that almost 100 years later, we're still having to argue this point. We're still having to fight for Serena to be able to wear whatever damn clothes she pleases. The greatest tennis player in the world right now is not allowed to wear the performance clothing that she needs to compete at the French Open. I just find that astonishing. And to compete for a trophy that is named after Suzanne Longlong. Anyway, before this week, she'd already encountered a whole load of stuff. Racism, of course. She was told that she was too masculine, too muscular, and it was unfair on her competitors. She was also told that she was too feminine and too sexual, and she looked like a prostitute. She was too pregnant, like Jess, and she was never going to be able to make a comeback. And yet within 13 games, I think it was, she made the Wimbledon final, just 13 games after having her daughter. Some of you may or may not be familiar with this story. It's an Indian sprinter called Dutty Chand, who was about to compete at the 2014 Commonwealth Games in Glasgow, when she was told that she was not woman enough. There's a big debate, particularly in athletics, raging about having the right chromosomes to compete in a women's event. I'm not talking about transgender, I'm talking about women who are born as women, brought up as women, and then find, when they stumble into the sporting arena, that they don't have the right genetics to conform to sporting decisions about who is male and who is female. Caster Semenya is the most famous example, but what's really important about Dutty, thank you, Sunshine, for completely erasing the wonder that is Dutty, is that despite coming from a rural area in northern India, she decided that she would take on this ruling of the IAAF, the International Athletics Association of Federation, and she took them to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, and she won. Their ruling had to be suspended. They didn't have the science to prove that the elevated testosterone levels that she had were significant enough to provide an advantage over her female competitors. This year, you may have heard that the IAAF has created a new ruling that now targets Caster Semenya and prohibits her from competing in her favoured events. Again, the science has been completely slammed. Many people have resigned. Leading scientists are calling it out and saying there is no evidence, there is not robust data to support this. This is really based in ideology that comes from a racist and sexist outlook. It's astonishing that in 2018 we're still having these conversations about sport. One of my last Shiro slides is, again, you may just be able to make out a woman diving on the floor, wearing some shades. Georgie Bullen, she plays goalball. She's visually impaired. When she was at school, she was told she was really, really rubbish at PE. And she was often made to sit out PE lessons and go to the library, which happens frequently if you're blind and visually impaired in a mainstream school. But she thought that she was quite good at sport. She played with her brothers, who are fully sighted. And Amazingly, ahead of the 2012 Games, she was picked up by the talent ID scouts for Paralympic Games, and they recognised her talent, and she was taught how to play goal ball, and she became the captain of the Great Britain women's team, which I think is wonderful. There are very few opportunities for women who are partially sighted or visually impaired to play team sport. I mean, amazingly, there's a men's blind national team. You can play, if you're a blind man, you can play football for England, but if you're a blind woman or visually impaired woman, you cannot. It does not exist. Can't see anything, can you? This is Ibtihaj Mohammed, a Muslim American fencer who wears a hijab and the first hijab wearing athlete to win an Olympic medal for the US. She's a huge trailblazer, and you might be able to make out that she's holding her Barbie doll up on the left. And again, it's really important to say that hijab wearing in sport has been a huge battleground. It was only in the last few years that FIFA allowed women to wear hijab on the pitch. They said it was a safety hazard, a piece of fabric on your head, safety hazard. Okay. And of course, in France, even though the ruling has been now overturned, if you play for the French national team, you still cannot wear hijab because of French rules around religious coverings, which, again, is just extraordinary. So we are still fighting those battles. Oh, thank you, Sunshine, for going away temporarily. Please come back out when we finish the talk. All of this led me to found an organisation called Women in Football. We just celebrated 10 years of our existence. And it was really just about supporting women in the football industry, whether they were playing football, whether they were coaching, whether they were, in the case of Jean-Mercy Ellis, trying to run the line or officiate at matches and being told by Richard Keys that they couldn't possibly understand the offside rule. So women couldn't be Nobel Prize winners, nuclear scientists, space exploration engineers, but they cannot possibly understand being offside. Astonishing, really. Women in the middle, Dame Heather Rabat, who was the first woman to join the FA board. That was only in 2012, so they'd existed 150 years before they let a woman in. And also the first person of colour. And then, of course, on the right, Jackie Oatley, who was the first woman to commentate on Match of the Day. That was 10 years ago, and it prompted national debate. She was doorstepped by tabloids, told that she must be a lesbian. I'm not sure what qualification that gives you to commentate on Match of the Day, but extraordinary. And it was really interesting this time around, the recent Men's World Cup in Russia, that Vicky Sparks was making history and commentating on Men's World Cup games for the BBC. And we did have, again, the same debate about whether women can possibly commentate on men's football, which just seems extraordinary to me. We have women reading the news, women running nations. Why could they possibly not describe the action on the field of play? Amazing. I'm going to be talking a bit more about this later at an event in the Red Tent with Lena Norms. But last year I set up a campaign called the Blue Plaque Rebellion, and it was really based out of a conversation I think is happening in many areas with the likes of Caroline Criado Perez and her campaign for Millicent Fawcett and the statue in Parliament Square. And there's more campaigns going on around that at the moment, with one of the Pankhurst statues apparently going to be removed. If you're interested in that, Google it and sign the petition. But less than 1% of sporting statues in this country are of women, amazingly. And neither of the sporting statues that do exist are of women of colour or women with disabilities. And this was something that I felt was really important to change, because I think women's relationship to sport partly stems from this idea that women in sport are really incompatible. But the truth is that women have been playing sport for millennia. They've just been breaking the rules to do it. They've had more obstacles in their way to do it. But the ones who have succeeded, like Suzanne Longlong and many others, are extraordinary. They're extraordinary women that I'd love this generation and future generations to know more about and to be inspired by. So the idea is that we've been going around putting up these gorilla blue plaques, celebrating these women all over the country, and at the same time lobbying governing bodies to try and invest some of their millions that they do have and changing the visibility of women around some of their sporting iconic venues. So when you go to Wembley, it would be nice to see some female footballers. If you go to the Emirates Stadium, I love seeing, you know, Bergkamp and Henri and all the rest of it. They're heroes of mine, but I would love to see a statue of Kelly Smith there too. Same when you go to Lourdes, or when you go to Wimbledon, or when you go to Twickenham, there are women that we should be celebrating. And you definitely won't be able to see any of these pictures. But these are a selection of black and white photos of some of these sporting heroines. So on the top left corner, you can possibly make out a team of a women's football team. They were the Ditka ladies, and they were playing in the 1920s. They're an incredible bunch of women. At their height, 1920, they played in front of 53,000 people at Goodison Park. So anybody who ever tells you that women's football is not popular and never has been is entirely wrong. 53,000 people went to watch them. The following year, the FA banned women's football, and they banned it for 50 years. And many of the women and men in this audience will have experienced not being able to play football at school as a result of that ban. So that ban was only lifted in 1971. And of course, the legacy and repercussions of that ban are still felt today. So I was never had the option to play football at school. And even today, for my six-year-old daughter, I'm still having to really, I was going to say fight, but I'm going to say work with the school to encourage them to put on a girls' football team. And to their credit, they have done now, which is great. But I don't think we should be in a place where we're having to say, there is a boys' football club, there should be a girls' football club. It should be obvious, I think, now. But I think the repercussions of that 50-year ban and then a lack of investment for another 40 years hang heavy in our culture. The sun's really shining now. You might just be able to make out on the bottom left the amazing Edwina Sandwin. She's lifting her husband up over her head. And her party trick was that she could carry three men and a bicycle. Which is wonderful. She was competing or showboating, really, in the early 1900s. And she was world famous. She was billed as the most beautiful strong woman in the world. And she was seen as beautiful. And again, I think that's really interesting, that a woman who was overtly about musculature and strength was also celebrated for her beauty. Bottom right-hand corner, there's a woman in the car. That's Dorothy Levitt. She was the first ever woman to be a motor racing driver. She was also from the Jewish East End. And no, you definitely can't see it. I can't even see it. But on the top right is Emma Clark, who was the first black female player in football, and she was playing in the 1890s. And she's a story that I'm trying to resurrect. This is my last photo. And a bit of a personal one, and you might not be able to see it either. But it's me and my friend, and we're in a boat on a river learning how to row, which I never, ever thought I would do. A girl from inner city London, never had any connection with the sport of rowing, never thought I would, never even reported on it, really, as a sports writer. But a couple of years ago, my friend and I, we both had young children, we didn't get to see each other very much. Very difficult having young kids, as anyone in the audience who has them will know. It's stressful, especially if you have to balance it with a job. And we decided, you know, let's go and start a sport together. Let's just try it. All this girl can stuff. Let's see if it applies to us as well. I said, you pick the sport, and she picked rowing. And I went, oh, God, I don't think I want to row, but I'll do it. And we researched and we found that even though, you know, where we live, she lives in Hackney, I live in just near Tottenham, Walthamstow, there is a river. It's got some baby wipes in it and a shopping trolley. But it's also got kingfishers and it's also beautiful, very beautiful and a very profound place. And I love the fact that it exists right in the middle of one of the most troubled parts of London, really. So we learnt to row. And the most wonderful thing was, pretty much early on, our coach said, you're really good. You're really good. You've got natural talent. We were very surprised by this revelation. And we couldn't work out why it was. And then after a little while, she said, how long have you two known each other? Because we're quite old. And I said, oh, about 25 years we've been friends. And she said, oh, that must be why then. Because you have an intuition with each other. You row really well together. And anyone who's ever rowed, if you haven't, you should try it. But anyone who has, it's very much about timing. Timing is everything. And finding this really fine-tuned balance between a kind of intuitive approach to movement and at the same time an extremely technical cerebral approach. It's a very strange sport in that sense, but very interesting. So here was someone saying that we were talented at a sport because we had this friendship. This friendship that went back for so long and that was filled with love and trust and shared memories and shared traumas too. I found that really, really powerful idea because throughout life we're kind of told that female friendship is something that's a bit silly and a bit frivolous and quite bitchy and that women often let each other down. And certainly didn't see it as something that would be key to performing well in a sport. And yet here it was. This was part of our excellence. This was the only way we were ever going to get near being a sort of a stunning and Glover duo. So I'm going to end the talk there. Thank you so, so much for listening and for bearing with our like highlighted slides. If any of you would like to share any of your stories via a question, really, we've got a lovely microphone at the front. And apparently you have to come up to the front. So here's a test of your bravery and courage and your commitment to women's sport. Would anybody like to come up to the front and ask a question? Yes, go on. Thank you.
How about we have a woman first? You can go second. Is that all right?
I want to go back right to the beginning where you had your Shiro's.
Oh, yes.
And it was Shira on Gladiators and Flojo.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, I mean, you kind of touched on it. How helpful is it to give out the message you can be sporty and sexy rather than, let's say, as happens in most men's sport, you can be good and whether you're sexy or not is your own damn business.
Yeah. That's such a good point. Thank you so much for asking that question. I think when I was growing up in the 80s, being sporty and sexy was quite a groundbreaking idea because they were so seen as incompatible in many ways. But I think now in 2018, it's not groundbreaking, it's not radical, and it's actually quite dull because so often sportswomen in the media are really forced to be sexy. And if they're not sexy, then they don't get the coverage and they don't get the sponsorship and all the rest of it, all of that frustrating stuff. And for that reason, I think we've certain sports have really suffered to get the coverage. So things like women's rugby, which are not seen as sexy for whatever reason, or, well, you know, the same old reasons that we know where femininity is straitjacketed and women are straitjacketed. So, yeah, thank you for that point. I think it's absolutely, absolutely true. And I don't. That's why I said I don't think they'd be my Shiro picks for my daughter. What was your question?
Hello.
Hiya.
Two things, if I may. First of all, I helped train Mel C, aka Sporty Spice, in the
gym.
No
way!
Yeah.
And really?
Ironically, she was in Jesus Christ Superstar playing Mary Magdalene. She's an absolute sweetheart, and yeah, she works her socks off, so that was my first comment. And the other thing that was I found really compelling is that me, my wife over there, we've been in and around the fitness industry for, well, myself, 19 years now. And I was just thinking about percentages with regards to gym attendance, and I would easily say, obviously a massive generalization, but about 70-30, so 70% are women, 30% are men. And what really hit home is that you said it's only 2% is represented in mainstream media. So why is it that more of the general populace are probably female that are exercising, but when they're so underrepresented in the media, why do you think that is?
I think it's purely cultural, and it's built around this idea that women doing exercise is to be applauded because it's to make your body look right, but women playing sport is a different thing altogether. That's something that women might do for enjoyment, and they might display really unseemly characteristics like competitiveness, which are not appreciated in mainstream society. And I think it's been brilliant to see the explosion of women in gyms and all this kind of fitspo stuff. But at the same time, thinking back to that, sport and exercise has its dark side. I think some of that has had a negative side, and it's been too much about, you know, when you look on Instagram and there's these women with like impossible bodies and they're giving recommendations about what kind of unrealistic diets, and I don't believe in diets anyway, but there's a lot of kind of negative pressure around there, which isn't just about enjoyment of the gym, if that's your thing. Like, if you want to go to the gym, you should be going because you enjoy it, because it makes you feel good, because it makes you strong, it makes you healthy. It's like stress release. Oh, you know all this stuff because you're doing it. But for too many women, going to the gym is like a punitive thing to change their bodies. And I think that's really problematic. So, but yeah, that's interesting that it's 70-30 in your gym and then, like you say, 2% in the newspapers. Yeah, sad. Oh, I love that you train Mel C. She's brilliant. She's so cool.
I wonder if I can ask you about kind of optimism versus pessimism. So I work in professional sports administration, and it's quite a still quite a patriarchal environment.
Yeah.
And on one hand, I think we've seen over the last kind of 5 years, or probably before that, kind of actually a real, you know, change in how women's sport is marketed and things like that, and a real effort being put into doing that. And that's great. And on the other hand, I still think, yeah, but it's such a low starting point, and it's still seen as something that's a bit optional. And if you're the one who, I do try and kind of be a bit like, yeah, but what about this? Well, and actually, that's kind of quite tiring to do when it's still a kind of, oh, this is a nice add-on. And, you know, there's so far to go, I think, even compared to normal society, the kind of differential between where we should be and where we are. How do you kind of, well, if you keep kind of hope for the good things without being depressed about the whole picture, if you see what I mean?
So how do you get the approach right in terms of not being overwhelmed by negativity? Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. I was talking about that in the shuttle bus on the way over here with someone who works for St Martin's in the fields. And we were talking about women's rugby and whether the RFU should spend their millions, they're the richest rugby governing body in the world, on women's rugby, or at least some of their millions. And I was saying that they should. And we were having this debate about how do you create equality and, you know, what should your approach be? And is it about justice or is it not? I think it is, and he didn't think it was. And some people get really affronted when you highlight the barriers and you talk about the negatives, because they only want you to talk about the positives. Equally, if you only ever talk about the negatives, you alienate people and you don't celebrate the wonderful achievements that are taking place. So I think that's quite an interesting question for any campaign, really. How do you get that balance right? For women in football, we've been going the last 10 years. And for much of that time, I think a lot of football kind of found us quite hard to accept. We were flagging the truths, flagging sexism and harassment, discrimination when it happened, and that made people feel uncomfortable. And in the last year of our organisation, we made this campaign called What If? And it was about making a pledge for change. And anybody could make a pledge. It could be, you can all still do it if you want to. You can take some kids to go and watch women's football, and that's your pledge. As a governing body, you could invest in women's kit for, you know, 10 teams across the country. Sky Sports, for example, their pledge was that they're going to have a female pundit on every midweek live game, men's football live game, which I think is a brilliant pledge. And it was amazing watching how this campaign just spread like wildfire across the football industry. Everybody wanted to get involved, all these like really archaic institutions, I should say. And why did they like it? They liked it because there was something positive that they could do to make a change. And it made them feel good. It didn't make them feel bad. So that was a really important lesson, an interesting lesson that I learned about trying to get that balance right. And I think all campaigners struggle with it, because if you don't highlight the negatives, then you're not being real and you're not being true to the situation. But if you only talk about the negatives, you'll never take everyone along with you. So, yeah, I hope that's helpful in some way. Thank you for your question.
Hello. I'm a PE teacher and teach A-level sport, particularly the sociology and sports section.
Yeah.
And my whole class are boys, which is annoying in itself. But when we cover underrepresented groups in sport, particularly gender, they feel hard done by as boys, because a lot of initiatives are for free stuff for girls. So we've just had a big grant to change our gym into a glow-in-the-dark space. Which is to get a load of girls involved because no one can see them and all that sort of stuff. But also boxing stuff to come in and football. So the girls actually get at our school a really, really, really good deal, which is great. Right. And the boys feel really hard done by. How would you approach that with 17, 18-year-old boys who are studying that at A-level?
Oh, that's a really hard question. And it's something that I'm starting to think about more and more. As somebody who spent, 10 years campaigning for women's empowerment, I think more and more we're starting to realise that, you know, Goodnight Rebel Stories for Girls and Hero Stories for Boys, why are we always segregating this idea of equality or empowerment? Why are we not addressing both genders at the same time or all genders at the same time? And I think increasingly we're starting to realise it's quite a problematic approach. I don't know if I have the answer to your question because I don't know 16, 17-year-old boys in the way that I'm sure you do. But I'll give you an interesting example of something that happened at my daughter's school that her teacher did that I thought was really interesting. So like most schools, every day the kids go out on the playground and the boys play football. And everybody who doesn't like football, including boys, are kind of pushed to the parameters of the playground. Classic. Anybody who's a teacher will probably know this. It's a really kind of interesting forerunner of like man spreading, basically. And it's quite troublesome. Girls particularly didn't get a look in. And so this particular teacher decided that on Friday playtimes, they were going to have a girls' football playtime. And she was going to play, even though she wasn't necessarily, she's not a PE teacher or anything, she was just going to have a go. And the kids are only like 5 and 6. So she joined in, and increasingly every week, more and more girls started to play. She didn't ban boys, but she said, you can join in with us, but this is predominantly for the girls to get a chance to play. And I thought that was the way that she was explaining it to the class, but it turned out that she wasn't. To the class, she was saying that this was also an opportunity for boys who always play football to learn to play something else. And she was challenging them to try a new game. And what I thought was really brilliant about that was it wasn't putting the onus on girls as the oppressed population that needed special attention and help, and it wasn't putting the onus on the boys as this kind of oppressors that were taking up the whole of the playground and excluding girls. But instead, this was that by girls learning to play football who wanted to, it was an opportunity for boys to learn something new themselves. And it is still kind of gender segregating, but I thought it was wonderful that she tried to create a balance in the experience of the two genders and therefore kind of bring them together in that way. And I don't think that's the whole answer to your question, but I think that kind of thinking is the way that we will find a better place. Because if we only ever focus on the experience of one group, it's always going to alienate the other, I think. So, it's a really interesting problem that you have, and I wish you all the best with it. I think it's really important. Do you know, I said if you make them come up to the front, nobody's going to ask a question, but you greenbelters are something else. I love it. Thank you so much.
I wanted to go back to the 2% in the newspapers coverage thing.
Yeah.
I read The Guardian quite a lot. I've got the app on my phone. Yeah. And I'm always looking for stories about women's sport.
Yeah.
And I feel, I'm sorry, you said you wrote for The Guardian. I happen to read
it's
The Guardian.
It's true, I say the same thing to them.
I feel I read as many articles about why there isn't coverage about women's sport as I read about women's sport.
Yeah.
And if they converted some of those articles into no one's writing about women's sport into writing about women's sport, that would be really good. And there was recently a Women's World Cup in hockey in London.
Yes.
And there was match reports, but not much more. And I was just like, come on, it's a World Cup. It's in London. We're the Olympic champions.
Yeah.
Can you write more about it, please? And I don't know. I don't know what you can do behind the scenes to kind of prod the editors a bit more, but anything would be good.
It's really hard. And thank you for your comment. The first thing I would say is, please, please write into The Guardian and let them know your thoughts. We have a reader's editor, and you can do this for any newspaper. They all have reader's editors, and the reader's editors are independent, so every department is accountable to them and will have to explain, you know, whether it's something inappropriate in the article that was maybe sexist or whether it was the fact that there wasn't an article at all or wasn't the right kind of article. So it's a really, really powerful tool that you all have as members of the public to change things. And believe me, it does change things because we had a huge tide of pressure following London 2012 to increase the women's sport coverage that we did. And all of those complaints came through to the sports editor, and it did change things. Not enough, as you've described, but it has changed things. And I think it's important to say that if you ever walk into the Guardian building one day, or even if you look across the different sections, and it will be the same across every newspaper, you'll see a lot of female bylines, or a lot of women writing about a lot of different subjects. It could be politics. We've got female politics editors, which is, you know, one of the most heavyweight subjects of our time. And yet you go to the sports section and you'll see very, very few female bylines. Something like less than 2% of national sports bylines are written by women. So not only are we not writing about women's sport, but we're not allowing women to write about women write about sport, whether that's women's sport or men's sport. There's huge barriers for women in the industry there, and it's very, very hard to change that. And often the attitude is that sport is just a different, it's its own world, and it's not answerable to the rules and ethics and ideas that the rest of the world has. So I think one of the last commenters said, you know, why is sport lagging behind the rest of society? It is, and we really need to change that. So please write in to sports editors and readers' editors and complain and highlight it and show that you care, because they always come back with the same argument that we don't need to write about women's sport because actually no one cares. And so we write about the things that sell newspapers, the things that get clicks online. And if you demonstrate that you do care and you will click on women's sports stories, then they will have to change their attitude.
And I'm going to suggest we take the last three questions all together, okay. And I'm going to ask all the questioners to be very brief because we're really pushing up against time.
Okay. I want to raise a sport which you haven't mentioned, but which I'm a huge fan of, cycling.
Brilliant sport.
Women have excelled and got coverage in most formats of cycling, track cycling, Laura Trott, Olympic road race, Anna van der Breggen, but they are totally excluded from the highest format of the sport, the three Grand Tours.
Yes.
Now, I want to ask, why can't there be a women's Tour de France, a women's Giro d'Italia, a women's Vuelta a España, with the women riding each stage the day before the men, and the final stages of each race involving closing the streets of Paris, Rome, and Madrid for an entire weekend? It will be an incredible visual spectacle. It would be seized on by the TV companies. I mean, there are people in the governing body who say, oh, well, women haven't got the stamina to ride a three-week Grand Tour. Come on! I mean, let's petition the governing body of World Cycling to bring in women's Grand Tours.
Thank you. That's a brilliant comment.
I loved all the pictures of your sporting heroes across a range of different sports. But what I'm interested in commenting on now is how much this conversation about women in sport has been about football. So why is football the only sport that is the touchstone of women's involvement?
That's an interesting question. Okay.
Thank you. Hi, so I'm a musical theatre student, and dance has been like a big part of my life with that. And so I've been going to private dance classes since I was about 5, and from then I've been told, oh, I'm too big, I can't dance, I need to lose weight.
Good God.
But then I've also been told you need the strength, but you can't be muscly.
Yeah.
But you need to stay skinny because of the aesthetic or you won't get a job anywhere. So I guess the question is, how can I push that within performing arts?
First of all, I'm so sorry to hear that. It's just outrageous. Interestingly, it reminds me of the experience that Mel C had, because she was a gymnast and a dancer when she started out. Not Mel C, Jet from Gladiator, sorry. She told me this story about how she was told she was too tall to dance and to be a gymnast. And it forced her really into this awful swirl of eating disorder. She became bulimic in the end because she was put under so much pressure. It was awful. And she felt that Gladiators saved her because it gave her a way of being muscular and strong and celebrating her physique. I don't think anybody that's in a professional setup like that should be putting pressure on a young woman to lose weight and be a different weight. It's just wrong. So first of all, I would try and get support from your family to go in and speak to them and say, hang on, this isn't right. It goes against everything that we know in society. And there's just no way that you should be put under that kind of pressure. Your talent is not dictated by your body. All these examples that we looked at, you know, Jessica Ennis, she would have been dismissed as too short. She was the national record high jump holder at 5'6" for years. People said it was impossible, but she had really springy legs. So, you know, or Kukina, Svetlana Kukina, who was a gymnast, who is 5'8". And again, people said, oh, she's too tall, she can't possibly be a gymnast. And now we've seen that, you know, Simone Biles and all these different body types are absolutely excelling at women's gymnastics. And it's not dictated by body types. So I think that's a really old-fashioned way of thinking. And I'm really sorry that you're being subjected to it. It's wrong. It's absolutely wrong. And just make sure that you've got the support around you to go and challenge it, or try and find a different environment, if you can, to be in that's more supportive. Because it's about your talent, not about your kilograms. very quickly.
Football and cycling.
Football and cycling. Okay, let's go to the cycling one, because that one was brilliant. I don't know if you noticed, but ahead of the Tour de France, there was a group of women who rode the whole course the day before. Really more as a protest, of course. It's absolutely ridiculous, as you so beautifully put it. There's no way that women shouldn't be able to compete on those long distance. Of course they should be able to. And it's, again, really archaic thinking. It's the same thinking that said that women couldn't ski jump, and that rule was only revoked in 2014 because they thought their wombs would fall out. No, really, that's what the president of the Ski Federation thought, and that's what he said. Stupid person. And the same reason that women weren't allowed to do marathons until 1984 when they started to compete in the Olympics. You know, it's archaic thinking. It's not science-based. If anything, we know that women are almost better at endurance events than men for some reason. And that's proved in ultra runners, where you often have women performing against men. So that's the short answer. I completely agree with you. And then the question about football. Why is football the touchstone? I think for a long time, women's football was completely ignored, certainly in the time that I've been covering sport. It was one of the sports, like women's rugby, that was right at the back of the queue to get coverage. And you would see women's tennis and other sports ahead of it getting much more coverage, and then those individuals being better paid. And in some ways, that is still the case. And I think football as a sport has been kind of taken up as a campaign, really, because it's the national sport and because it so starkly shows the difference of inequality between men's sport and women's sport. You couldn't get it better illustrated between men's football and women's football. But I think you're right that we shouldn't lose sight of all the other wonderful sports out there. And probably you could have the same argument in terms of coverage about sport. We always get letters from people who love, for example, rugby league, and say, why have you constantly got men's Premier League football in the paper, but you don't cover rugby league? Look at the millions of fans that there are. So there's always going to be complaints about how you cover or what airtime you give to different sports. But I think women's football is kind of trying to reclaim that ground after many years of being ignored. I think we've run out of time. Thank you so much for having us. Thank you for coming.